You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.
How do we become a sustainable world? As the stakes for our survival continues to rise, so does our global consciousness. We are in the midst of a great spiritual awakening and are laying the foundations for a happy, peaceful, just, and sustainable world. With clear vision, determination, and a positive attitude, we are making sustainability happen. The transformation is already underway. You are listening to Sustainable Futures.
Welcome to Sustainable Futures. I hope you're having yourself a great day. Today we're going to talk about ecosystems and also a particular part of our ecosystem that is looking to be of great value. Two interviews. The first interview is going to be on the idea of eco-health, ecologically healthy environments. Kimberly Tay, a while back, had an interview with Margot Parks, who is an expert on eco-health, and they're talking about the environment and the way that it relates to a healthy lifestyle. It's a very interesting interview. And the second interview is going to be on algae. I had an interview with Cameron Cotes, and we talked about algae, because algae is sort of like the superstar kind of potential superstar of sustainability. It's being studied in California, and Cameron Cotes is one of the people that is really working on algae and looking at its applications towards the sustainable movement. So that's very interesting. If you didn't dig algae before, I bet you will by the time we're through with the program here today. I actually happen to know a couple of people just in my social circles of my lifetime that have been studying algae. People are fascinated with algae. So first is, it's Kimberly Tay interviewing Margaret Parks.
Today I'm speaking with Dr. Margot Parks. Thank you very much, Margot, for joining me on the show today.
You're very welcome.
Today we're talking about the whole idea of an ecosystem approach to health, what is also known as eco-health for short. Can you start by giving a definition of what the ecosystem approach to health is and what it aims to accomplish, or what the actual goal of looking at health in this way is?
Sure. Well, an ecosystem approach to health has emerged as a reflection of the fact that people's health and well-being is embedded within the ecosystems that we live in. And a key part of that idea is that we're not just talking about the environment as a source of things that may make us sick, but we're also thinking about the environment as an ecosystem that is life support system. And so understanding the ecosystem also helps us understand what promotes our health and well-being.
How would you define health within this model?
Well, you've probably heard the old definition that health is more than the absence of disease. And that's quite an important thing to ponder, because when we think about the health, the way that the public and the way that many people, in fact, think about health, they do often default to thinking about it in terms of disease. And so the health system is often responding to problems once they've already arisen. So the health sector also is sometimes, people jokingly call it the sick sector rather than the health sector. We're often responding to things after they've gone wrong. And an orientation to health in the broader sense that is about promoting health and well-being is about trying to create healthy and enabling environments and communities. So it's about healthy people and healthy communities and healthy ecosystems.
Awesome. So how do you actually, like within the eco-health approach, how do you actually go about investigating these issues?
Well, actually, that's a good question, because when we investigate issues, people often think about trying to just understand a cause and effect relationship. So what's the nasty thing in the environment that's making people sick? Can we count the sick people and identify the nasty thing and prevent people from being exposed to it? And that's been a traditional approach to understanding research that links health and environment. But it's quite a limited approach that doesn't necessarily focus on understanding and investigating solutions to those problems and issues. And so eco-health in the broader sense is a very applied field. It's about trying to bring together knowledge we have that understands what may or may be helping promote health or creating ill health, and then also investigating how we can find solutions to that. Who needs to be involved? Who needs to talk to who? How do we need to bring different knowledge and perspectives together to find solutions to these issues?
What can eco-health contribute to our mainstream understanding of sustainability and environmentalism?
Well, one of the key steps to understanding is recognizing that when we think about sustainability in the broad sense, and we think about, sometimes people refer to the triple bottom line of sustainable development, for example. They talk about the relationship between the economy, between the environment and society, those three things that form the triple bottom line. One of the things that's not very well understood is that when you take a different perspective, those are also the determinants of health, the environmental determinants of health, the social and socioeconomic determinants of health have received increasing recognition as being just as important for how healthy people are as their behaviours, their individual behaviours. And so at its core, it's understanding that in many ways, sustainability and promoting health and well-being have a lot of common goals. I don't know if that helps to answer that question.
I think it does, definitely. How easy is it to actually apply this ecosystem approach to health? Like, what are the challenges? And are we sort of missing a part of the whole understanding that perhaps makes it challenging to actually implement?
Yeah, well, one of the challenging parts of the phrase is the idea of a system and many interrelationships. So we've tended to try to understand things by dividing them into their small parts so that we can understand a little piece of the puzzle. And sometimes we can develop quite specialized and very focused understanding of one dimension of the problem or another, but the piece that's been missing is how we bring that knowledge together and how we get an understanding of the system as a whole. And unfortunately, although one would like to think that people are doing that, many of our institutions, our universities, our government institutions are not designed to do that, to tackle that task of integration and synthesis. And so we end up with a situation where nobody is thinking of the big picture, nobody is joining the dots. And so eco-health is deeply challenging in that regard, because it requires us to do what we've always been doing and to do something else, which is to make the connections between different types of knowledge. It's important also to recognize that's just not academic knowledge. Research can bring very important understanding to solving complex problems, but there's other types of knowledge that may be equally as helpful, and often that may be individuals who live in particular communities or environments, local community knowledge of not-for-profits or community groups that have a very close and intimate understanding with how things manifest in the real world. And then there's also, beyond the academy, there's also the policy understandings of these issues. So you can start to see that understanding the whole system also means that you have to respect and value and find ways to listen to those different perspectives. So as you pointed out, that can be a very challenging, time-consuming process. But if we don't do it, then we're simply not using the knowledge that we have adequately.
And you're almost feeding the problem more than you are working to solve it.
It can create a real dilemma where that we can propose from a very isolated perspective, we can propose solutions that could potentially make the problem worse. And so one of the challenges of an eco-health approach is actually finding and initiating processes that do integrate those different types of knowledge into the understanding from the outset. And that involves a little bit of a, it's not business as usual.
Yeah, that was actually my next question, is how do you go about joining those dots then? Like, how do you bring people together and create an environment of more collaborative learning and more collaboration?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the critical elements that is time-consuming is listening, rather than parachuting in with fixed ideas of solutions for problems. Is actually creating opportunities to listen to different perspectives and learn from those. But it's also a matter of people in some ways need to be, can learn a lot of specialized knowledge, but people are also recognizing they need to learn how to collaborate and what is collaborative learning. Interestingly, one of the fields that has put a lot of effort into thinking about this is the field of interprofessional education for health. And sometimes that's quite helpful for people where they recognize that if somebody's unwell in hospital, for example, if there's a problem, it's important for the nurses, the social workers, the nutritionists, the doctors, and all these different knowledges to come and focus on the particular person in their context and trying to find the best solution. In many ways, in local communities, you have the same challenge. You have an issue. You have a patient, possibly a sick river or a contaminated site or a concern about a local community development. And you need to ask the same question. Whose knowledge do we need to bring to the table to understand this problem? How can we do that in a way that people will feel respected and listened to? And how can we also make sure that we're trying to not just come up with a solution, we're recognizing that it'll be a process where we may need to adapt, we may need to try something, see if that's working. If it's not working, we may need to adapt. So they're all pretty challenging things. It's not necessarily how we normally go about things.
How comfortable are people with this way of doing things? Like if people are used to doing things in a certain way, how do they react to it?
One important motivator for people is recognizing that the way they have been doing things hasn't worked. And so there is a recognition. Many people come to be interested in the field because they've been working as a particular researcher or a particular policymaker, and they've been coming from their particular silo or world, and they've started to realize that they need to learn more about other people's perspectives and that we don't need to reinvent the wheel. We may just need to listen to somebody else's perspective too. And that the failure to do that in the past has often made things worse. And so many people come to the field because they recognize that if they don't, they may actually be helping to make the problem, exacerbate the problem rather than help to solve it. So that's a big motivator. Another motivator is people who are not necessarily willing anymore to take a more integrated issue in a local community that's grappling with a concern around food security or land use or other issues, and they don't want to divide it up anymore. They do actually want to look at the problem as a whole. And so there is a recognition that if they want to just bring in particular expertise, they may only get one perspective on the issue.
Okay. How long has it actually been in place? Is there actually like a year or when it started to kind of come about?
There's a couple of big markers in time that are notable. One is that in the late 90s, there was a lot of interest, growing interest in the phrase ecosystem health. And there was also some really interesting Canadian programs that came under the umbrella of eco-health or ecosystem approaches to health that were funded by the International Development Research Centre, which is an interesting Canadian organisation. In 2003, an important mark point was the launch of a journal called EcoHealth. And the journal has been a place where some of this thinking has, it's been a forum for this kind of thinking to be cultivated and for people to see different perspectives on this emerging field. In 2006, the journal became the flagship of a new international association called the International Association for Ecology and Health. So those are some of the landmarks, and it's important to recognise that in the meantime, many people in Canada and throughout the world have been building experience in this kind of integrated approach. And so these are some additional steps towards consolidating the field.
So it's quite a new field.
Yeah, in some ways it is, but as with many of these ideas, it's an expression of, in fact, ideas that have been around for a very long time. One point that our Canadian community practice in EcoHealth acknowledges is that Indigenous knowledge has a very important both precedent and contribution to this emerging field, because the understanding of the close connections between the health of individuals, their communities, and the broader environment has been a very important part of Indigenous knowledges for millennia. And so you could argue that this is a rediscovery of old things, and certainly the field is not trying to claim that it's new. It's just in its current form, it's being a place and a forum, an opportunity for people to come together and to try to progress it further.
How do you think that we slipped away from that way of thinking?
That's a very big question. You could take a view of 2,000 years and understand the whole evolution of Western philosophy and science.
Right.
You could also take a view of a couple of hundred years and to recognize that science has evolved in a very particular way that does value and inform society in terms of specialized knowledge. And that is something that in the last 100 years has really come into play. And there was a lot of hope that specialized knowledge would create magic bullets that may mean that we don't have to deal with this messy, time-consuming reality of our intimate relationship with nature. But it's over the last 50 years, the awareness of the consequences of not understanding our intimate relationship with the life support system that is the planet and our local ecosystems, it's become very obvious that we have lost sight of that connection. And so the challenge for us is that remaking that connection is not business as usual for the way that a lot of our institutions and organizations have evolved, which makes it particularly challenging. Some people would say it's just common sense, and the problem is that that's not necessarily how we have set ourselves up to deal with problems. So the shift in how to refactor common sense into around the connections between nature and health into the way we do things is a big challenge ahead. Yeah. And this field is just one contribution to that type of thinking.
For sure.
You are listening to Sustainable Futures on CJSF 90.1 FM. This is Kimberly Tay interviewing Margaret Parks.
Is the EcoHealth approach particularly useful in certain environmental problems that we face, or can it be kind of applied generally to multiple different
kinds?
Yeah,
that's a very good question. I would emphasize that there traditional approaches to research and science about environment and health problems has a very important role in understanding specific problems and the specific effects, for example, the toxicological effects of particular pesticides or contaminants. And this is not a replacement of that type of thinking. And so some issues or problems will need a very precise approach to the science of understanding that particular dilemma. Where an EcoHealth approach comes in is often where problems are a little bit more complex, where it's obvious that those responsible, it's not clearly falling in the domain of this being a health issue or this being an environment issue or this being a community issue, and where even from a discipline point of view within universities, it's not quite clear what's the discipline that has the relevant knowledge to help solve this problem? Is it the Department of Geography? Is it the Department of Environment? Is it the Department of Population Health? Who should be giving us the knowledge? And the answer is that no one type of knowledge or no one sector is going to be able to understand it or solve it in isolation. So it's in those types of problems, which are increasingly common, where this more collaborative approach that EcoHealth proposes becomes particularly relevant.
Okay. Where do you even start? Like, when you're thinking about really complex situations, where does EcoHealth start in looking at those problems? Or is there even a right, like, one particular place to start?
Well, it often involves trying to take stock of the existing knowledge of a problem, and that would lead you to a next step. So sometimes EcoHealth work may lead you to identify gaps in existing knowledge that need to be filled, or by taking stock of who knows what about this issue and who talks to who, you may recognize that what is needed is not new knowledge, but is better use of existing knowledge. And so it may be a matter of bringing those different groups together to listen to each other, to hear how their knowledge can inform each other, and then identifying a next step that it makes sense to those groups of people. So part of the important starting point is really taking stock of the existing situation and the existing knowledge, which sounds very much like the sort of thing that should happen in most situations, but unfortunately we have a pretty bad reputation for not actually taking stock of what already exists around a problem and not necessarily being informed by what we already know. We have a rather long-standing tendency to do new research and new things and propose new policies when we haven't necessarily taken stock of what has worked in the past and just learned from what has worked well, what isn't working well, what do we need to do next? And again, they come back to being quite common sense things that are not particularly glamorous because these are not tasks that earn you a big splash in terms of grand new scientific discoveries. They are rather the slow but important process of using the existing knowledge we have better and listening to each other and finding ways to progress that are not going to make the problems worse but can help us learn into a healthier and more sustainable future.
Can you give a specific example of where EcoHealth is in being practiced right now?
There's some extremes that you can think about. One extreme I like to mention is that some people do EcoHealth research that is at the global level, so they may actually be trying to understand and integrate our understanding of global climate change and emerging infectious diseases, for example. Those are big global meta problems. And then at the other extreme, you may have people working in Ecuador trying to understand, using an EcoHealth approach, to the impact of pesticides in banana plantations in Ecuador. So you've got a whole range in between where you're dealing with the dynamics of health, ecosystems, and community development across the board. In the Vancouver context, when we ran our EcoHealth course at UBC, we chose to focus on two particular issues. One was the quite fascinating and complex story of the what is sometimes referred to as the killer fungus, Cryptococcus gattii, and that has been emerging in Vancouver Island and in the Pacific Northwest over the last 10 years and has received some particular profile in Vancouver Island more recently. That particular example was very useful in the students understanding the needs to understand the local ecosystem, to recognize the value of different types of knowledge, whether it's the vets that are dealing with animals that are falling sick from this issue through to the doctors, to the public health people that are dealing with public concern around the risks to children who might go on vacation in areas where Cryptococcus is a problem. And it was a very helpful example to show that there's not one particular type of knowledge that's going to solve the Cryptococcus issue. We also chose to focus on things that are slightly more local to Vancouver, and we were particularly interested in the food security example, because food security is one of those things where we can really understand the connections between the soil and water and air and that what is required to create sustainable agriculture, and can start making the connections between what people eat, how accessible food is, how safe it is, and how sustainable agriculture and sustainable communities are intimately entwined. And the students were able to see some of those issues playing out, for example, at the UBC farm, where there are some very pressing issues around how, when there is competition for land use, how farmland and rural farmland and accessible local agriculture may potentially come under threat because of other development pressures on land and so on and so forth. So this is an issue that the food security and the source of food is an issue that is relevant in many, at the rural-urban interface for many communities. So those are a couple of examples.
It's applicable to a number of different subjects.
Yes, it is. And I guess that's reflects that we are, just as humans individually are complex, their relationships with nature and the ecosystem are complex. And it's not simply a relationship that you only have in your recreation, for example. The relationship between ecosystems and health is one of the most intimate relationships we have. It relates to the very air that we breathe. It relates to the food we eat and how safe and sustainably produced that is. It relates to what happens with everything we put into our mouths, and also what happens with all of the things, the waste products that we as individuals or as a society produce. And all of these dynamics, just the basic functionings of life, are a reflection of our relationship between the relationship between health and the ecosystem.
How do you think that we can drive that message home more? Because, you know, I see that some of the trends that are currently going on in environmentalism and the more mainstream environmentalism, I guess you could say, you know, like buying eco-fashion or just kind of those little things that are deemed to be environmentally friendly. But I don't know, and maybe I'm just looking at it from a different perspective, but it's not really making that connection. Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. And I think that I find that it is very helpful to make the distinction between the environment, which is something that we have tended to think of as out there, as a thing that we take from in terms of how we consume or in the things that we may affect in terms of the products we buy and so forth. But it's separate from us. It's a thing that's out there. Whereas when you use the word ecosystem, you start to understand these interrelationships a little bit better. It's a difference that you've asked how we can drive it home better. Personally, I feel that the issues that are going to drive these messages home are the ones that are the really personal ones, such as the food we eat and the water we drink and the ways in which those are some of the most intimate things that we do. The food we eat, the water we drink, the air we breathe, is when people start understanding that if we can help people to see that they are part of the ecosystem and the ecosystem is part of them, we will take a different step than this idea of us living in our little disconnected urban world with the environment out there. But it's very challenging. Sometimes these ideas make people uncomfortable.
How so?
Well, it's kind of messy. The fact that our bodies are our little ecosystems of their own and made up of millions and millions of healthy bacteria, as well as the ones that make us sick, is a notion that is very foreign to people and is pretty scary, because we've been led to believe that bacteria are bad and dirt is bad and that we need to live in a very hygienic, clean environment that's separated from all of that sort of messy, natural stuff. And although we want to step out into that environment to recreate, maybe we want to play and go and play in the water or in the dirt or go hiking, or it's something that is, it's become disconnected from our urban reality, which is very disconnected. And so sometimes just that reality, that the idea that we are the food that we eat, is one that is, it can be a bit disconcerting to people.
Like the whole idea of composting.
The whole idea of composting is a very good example, where the fact that the soil that has grown the food that we're eating, that we're buying from the nice clean supermarket, has been the product. It's part of the life cycle. It's part of the process of life and the ecosystem reforming itself, and that we're totally dependent on that. Mm-hmm. It's a type of understanding that is quite different than the what many people have been exposed to or thought that they're aspiring to as well. Mm-hmm. But I think some of the more exciting initiatives are those ones that are attempting to rekindle an understanding, for example, of our food system or of the water systems, whether that's in school projects or family projects or recreation projects, or that where people are learning by doing, they're not just talking about it.
Like farm folk, city folk.
Yeah, those sorts of things.
Yeah.
I mean, they are, and the fact that it is pretty radical for kids who have never seen a vegetable growing in a garden to understand that that's where they come from, and that brown, ooky dirt stuff is the thing that brings it to life. And those are basic educational notions that authors like David Orr, for example, have written pretty passionately about, the fact that education has tended to not orient us to basic ecological realities. And so it's a matter of the things that are the most exciting are the creative ideas for reintroducing that and making it exciting and inspiring and hopeful, that that's the sort of thing that really brings it to life. Mm-hmm. And that learning from other people, that learning from different perspectives, and is also, it's challenging, but it's also inspiring and fun, and it often is a real source of hope. And when people are grappling with sources of doom and gloom, cultivating hope and inspiration is something that's definitely worth doing.
Definitely, for sure. What could be one message that you want people to walk away with after listening to this?
I'd probably just challenge people to get involved with their own learning process. It's not something that somebody else is going to solve for them. And so finding ways for you to extend out of your comfort zone to learn, whether it's about where your food comes from or what a person from another part of the university might think about the same issue that you think, or talking to your family about some of these issues, challenging yourself to really think about yourself as part of the ecosystem and what that might mean for how you learn and what you choose to do.
Thank you so much, Margot, for sharing your perspective with me today.
Well, I hope it's been helpful. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
So I hope you enjoyed that interview with Margot Parks. It certainly does make a difference, the environment you're in, as far as how healthy you are. I like how she, in the early part of the interview, talked about how we kind of tend to define health as the absence of disease. It's sort of only when we're sick do we think about our health. And that seems to be rather backwards to me. And hopefully we'll come up with ways of really looking at the whole person, more of a whole way of looking at someone's health. I know there's lots of fields of health that are doing that. They're just not mainstream. Something I hope is on the horizon. And now next, something that is looking to be on the horizon is the use of algae as a energy source. It's pretty fascinating, but I'll not tell you about it. I'll let my interview with Cameron Cotes explain this to you, because he certainly spends a lot more time with algae than I do. Hello, this is Ryan Fletcher of Sustainable Futures with Cameron Coates, and we're going to talk about the sustainable potentials of algae. Now, you're coming from a university in San Diego. Which university are you at?
We're at University of California, San Diego, and Scripps Institution of Oceanography.
All right. What is the value of algae for sustainability?
Well, algae has a number of advantages as a biofuel, and the reasoning why it can be used as a biofuel is that algae are incredibly productive, but they also make a lot of oil and they make a lot of sugars. And so the oil that they produce can be used to make conventional oils that we use for fuel, and we can then turn that into a variety of different other products that we couldn't normally use for fuel. But the reasoning behind why algae is advantageous to use as a biofuel is, number one, it's high productivity, which I mentioned. Number two, it can be grown on non-arable land. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't have to compete for food. And we can also use the nutrients and the water to grow that algae a lot more efficiently. We can recycle those nutrients and the water, and it's a lot less intensive on our resources. Can also grow them in salt or brackish water. The non-fuel portion of the algae can be recycled in other end uses like food or, for example, can use those other products for other types of fuels. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, if you want to make ethanol instead of oil. The other large advantage is that it can be carbon neutral or very close to carbon neutral because algae grow by absorbing CO2 and then make their lipids and proteins and carbohydrates. So the means to be able to make a fuel that takes up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere is a lot better than using a fuel that took up carbon dioxide from ancient atmospheres.
Yeah, that sounds...
There is some technology to be able to use wastewater nutrients to be able to grow algae. And so that adds another advantage to sort of to accomplish multiple goals at once of remediating wastewater, growing fuel, and making high-value products.
Wow. And algae, I would think, would be fairly common to come across. Is this just regular algae, or what kind of algae are we talking about specifically?
That's a good question. So there are really diverse types of algae. The name algae applies to a variety of different kinds. There are cyanobacteria, which are blue-green algae, and they are more closely related to bacteria, but they photosynthesize. And there are also green algae, brown algae, golden algae, and those are all different types of algae that can grow in diverse types of habitats. So one of the advantages to use algae in this kind of context is that there are diverse kinds, and they have equally diverse metabolic diversity. So the types of chemicals and compounds that they can make really is variable, and you can use those to your advantage when you're trying to make a high-value product or fuel.
Do they all have the ability to make the fuel?
That's an important question. So the cyanobacteria have been researched to see how much oil they can produce, and most of the literature doesn't show that cyanobacteria can produce much more than 10% of their biomass as oil. But they could be useful, presumably, in another context to make a different type of product. So if you were trying to make carbohydrates, cyanobacteria might be useful for that. But green algae and diatoms and brown algae, those all are found to make a little bit more oil, and they generally produce between 20 to 30% mm-hmm. of their biomass as oil. Some have been found to produce up to 80% of their biomass as oil. So you can see how, very quickly how your cost estimates and your estimations of yields for oil can really vary depending mm-hmm. on what species you use.
What kind of lifespan, I guess, does an algae have?
There are a number of algae that have different life stages, and they'll move from growing from a spore into a asexually producing algae that can grow and double within a span of hours. And then there are some that take many days to double in time. But when you're trying to grow algae for a large mass system, then you want to be able to grow that algae at the highest productivity rate that you can. And generally, that's a doubling time within hours. And mm-hmm. you want to get somewhere around 3 to 5 doubles per day. And that selects down to a smaller grouping of algae that can grow with high productivity. Mm-hmm. And so the lifespan would be, you know, on the order of hours to days.
How big can an algae get, I guess, if it's going to be doubling so frequently?
Generally, when you're trying to grow algae at high productivity, you want to use smaller algae because they have a larger surface area, I guess, to volume ratio, and they can reproduce and be exposed to light a lot more frequently. Uh-huh. And so you usually try and get small algae that grow to be around 1 to maybe 30 microns. Micrometers, and these are thousands of a meter, and they're very small. So uh-huh. you can't see a single cell with your naked eye, you have to use a microscope that's at, say, 1,000 magnification of your normal eye.
Wow.
They're small. They're small, definitely. And but the benefits of having small algae are really that you can get the entire culture that you're growing, for example, exposed to light rapidly, and you can get highly dense cultures. The densities that are needed to be able to make algae viable as a product for fuel and to get the cost down, which I'll get to in a second. The around a gram per liter or up to, say, hundreds of grams per liter. The goal in some commercial products are to try and make the densities feel and look kind of like peanut butter. And so one of the large research challenges is learning how to grow algae at incredibly dense cultures and the means to be able to get them to mix well and to deliver the nutrients to all those algae that are in a very dense culture is very difficult.
Quite an interesting project.
Well, I'm excited about it. I think when we face some of the larger challenges with respect to climate change and energy supply that we have, algae comes out a much better and more sustainable product than most others. For myself, I'm compelled to be able to be in this field just as a means to be able to mitigate climate change. But I also see that it's a growing industry, and I think you and probably many others have seen that there are a lot of news reports about algae as a fuel. And the key for us is to be able to put the effort in to do the appropriate research and show that this is a viable solution. And the means to do that really requires investments from both private and public partners. So we need to learn a lot about how to grow algae fuel, and we need to learn the same amount that we know about corn, for example. Corn is a really well-researched product, but the understanding of how algae partition their energy into lipids or into carbohydrates and proteins, how that's regulated, and understanding how to grow them at high dense cultures, these are all research problems that haven't been solved, and they need to be investigated a little bit more. And there are companies and there are efforts underway that produce algae for large commercial scale product currently, but they produce them at very high costs, somewhere around $120 to $150 per gallon. And the goal for most research projects that I've seen have been to try and get algae biofuel down to $1 to $2 or $3 a gallon.
Yeah.
And the means to be able to do that really requires a number of different breakthroughs.
And how would it stand as a renewable resource? Being so small, I think it might do well, but what are your thoughts on that?
I have seen many different types of renewable resources put forward, and I think the reality is that we need, as a society, many different types of renewable resources. And if you have a finite resource, like, for example, fossil fuels, you end up in a difficult scenario where you end up trying to cost yourself out of being able to use it. And so as a renewable resource, algae is more competitive than all other biofuels that are put out towards the market right now. And I have definitely seen that if you're trying to make electricity, for example, from algae, it probably won't do as well as trying to use a solar panel. And the means are that you're, in effect, harvesting the sun in two different methods. And by harvesting it through algae, you end up losing energy by harvesting, going after the extraction of that oil from the algae. And the reasoning behind why that still makes it a viable renewable resource is that you can't make oil directly from sunlight or electricity without a product to be able to make that oil in the first place.
You are listening to Sustainable Futures on CJSF 90.1 FM. This is an interview with Cameron Coates on algae. So let's get into how this works then. Like, it's through the sunlight somehow that the oil is made?
That's correct. So algae are photosynthesizing, and they're using the energy and the photons of light from the sun, and they're turning that into chemical energy through photosynthesis. So they're taking up carbon dioxide and they're putting that into complex molecules like carbohydrates, proteins, and oils. And as that little machine of a single-celled algae is working to maybe make these metabolites, then they can grow rapidly. And so as they are photosynthesizing and making their products, then we can harvest those by taking that algae out of the pond, for example, that we're growing them in, and you need to centrifuge them or filter them out of the water. And the means to be able to get the water away from the algae is a non-trivial thing, but there are a lot of engineering solutions that have been come up with for that.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you have them separated from the water, you need to extract the oil from the single cells and separate the oil from the carbohydrates and proteins.
And how is that done?
So that separation is traditionally done in our lab by using solvents, and you basically are taking a solvent that can flip the cell inside out, and that gets the lipids soluble and into that solution, and you separate the oil from the water that you have, and you can then dry down that solvent that has the lipids that are soluble in it through evaporation, and you end up with an extract, mm-hmm. a crude extract of algae that's very similar to oil that you can take from the ground. A lot of the oil that we are currently using for fossil fuels is actually from algae that were growing in the ocean millions of years ago.
So what our traditional source is basically like fossilized versions of what's going on right now?
That is the case. So there's lots of photosynthetic algae in the ocean that are currently making oils and carbohydrates and proteins, and they settle to the bottom of the seafloor and are then pressurized, and they turn into fuel, or they turn into oil over long periods of time. And it's currently not viable to harvest algae from the ocean as it's growing right now because the densities are so low.
Okay, I guess one concern might be, and I'll put this out there, is there concern about the health of the oceans and like our bodies of water, because a lot of pollutions and things are happening. Could that threaten algae?
What we're currently proposing is to grow algae on
sort of
land,
in a lab.
And to grow them with saltwater or brackish water that is currently available in underground aquifers, and grow them in a controlled setting that's on land.
Right.
And the pollution that you're talking about is mostly focused on coastal areas where you have sewage outflow or wastewater outflow, and we have a number of different agricultural products that go into our waterways, and they absolutely can alter an ecosystem. But for the most part, when you have high nutrients that are put into coastal areas, you end up increasing productivity of algae and grow a lot of algae in those kind of settings. And the means to be able to mitigate those wastewater problems, I think, can lie in algae. If you were to control the growth of algae on land with mm-hmm. those wastewater outflows, then you might be able to send that water out into the coastal ecosystems in a lot more clean condition.
So it'll basically eat up all the mucky stuff?
That's correct. So it'll take up trace metals. It'll also take up nutrients, like, for example, a lot of nitrogen. Nitrogen is often a waste nutrient from agricultural system, and it will also take up a lot of the different other trace metals, as I mentioned before. And so these things can be pollutants to our local waterways.
Like the household dog of the water world.
In some ways, yeah. I don't know if I'd want to feed my dog trace metals, but it probably would use up a lot of nutrients, and so they definitely can use up a lot of the waste that we don't want. And I think algae has a lot of potential to mitigate waste and produce a lot of products that we want in the long run.
Okay. Well, one thing that I read is that algae is being proposed as a solution for planes. Is it that good? Like, could it be that much? Do you really believe that that's a possibility?
Absolutely. And the proposition to use algae as a means to make jet fuel is just in line with making it for any fuel. And if you're going to make oil from algae, that oil can be converted into the fuels that are needed for jets. And jet fuel is different from our gasoline or diesel fuel that we use, simply because it has shorter chain lengths of the hydrocarbons that are put into it. So it's more volatile. And the means to be able to change the oil that you get from algae into a fuel that can be used for jets is currently available in the refineries that we have all across the world that convert oil that's extracted from the ground and converted into jet fuel. And what's been shown is that the larger cost of making jet fuel from algae doesn't lie in converting it to a jet fuel, converting that oil into jet fuel or any other types of fuels. The cost really lies in the growth of the algae. And currently that's where the challenges, the research, mm-hmm. larger research challenges lie. So the key is that you need to make enough. And I think that was part of your question is, can it make enough oil?
Yeah.
And just for an idea of scale, the estimates of how much oil you would need really depend on how much oil you can get out of that culture. Say, like I was describing before, between 10 to 50% of your biomass. But to make enough oil to run our entire transportation in the United States, for example, we would need it to grow algae on the scale of the size of Kansas. And so I don't think anybody is currently expecting us to grow that much algae and need that much oil from algae immediately. Uh-huh. But I think that the research objectives to really increase our productivity and make it so that you can grow it on in a smaller scale and increase your densities, then I think that that estimate would probably even be able to go down.
And what is your specific work in at of University of California?
I currently work in the field of marine natural products, and so I'm a biochemist, and our efforts in our lab is to try and increase oil productivity from algae, and so we're using a variety of small molecules to add to our cultures of algae and increase the percentage of oil that we can get. And we also are trying to find high-value products from the amount of the biomass that's not used for fuel. Those include trying to find drugs that we can use, or to try and find chemicals that can be used for the fine chemicals industry. And those are our main objectives in this research endeavor. But I have been working in growing algae and researching algae for a while now, and our lab is over 25 years of effort with that. Scripps Institution of Oceanography has been researching algae biochemistry for over 40 years. And
is this a pioneering research?
The work in my lab has not been researched before, and mm-hmm. so I guess we might meet some criteria of pioneering.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we, of course, have collaborators, and the effort that we're trying to put forward is key in trying to make algae fuel cost-effective. I've seen the broad amount of effort put into growing algae is essential, and all of it is pioneering. And mm-hmm. the key really is that nobody has been able to make oil from algae at a large scale and make it cost effective. So the research that's going on right now and the amount of funding that's going towards that kind of effort is really a pioneering endeavor.
Okay, well, that's really exciting. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about with us here today?
Well, one thing that your listeners might be interested to know is the key to understanding how sustainable algae fuel is to think about it in the context of the sort of environmental challenges that we have. And so I see algae as a means to be able to mitigate wastewater problems that we have, and also to be able to make a sustainable carbon neutral fuel. But to consider another possibility, if we wanted to be able to make algae for oil as a carbon negative, you can make plastics from algae. And the same way that we make plastics from oil that we currently have, if you made plastics from the algae oil, then you would be able to sequester that carbon dioxide into a product that stays on the surface of the planet mm-hmm. and doesn't go back into the atmosphere. So that in that way, it becomes even more appealing as a means to be able to reduce our climate change challenges.
You're able to use pretty well the whole algae, from what I understand.
That's the goal.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think there are a number of ways that have been proposed in which you can do that. And I've seen some research that shows that there are aspects of recycling each part of that algae into either a product that's useful to our society or a product that can go back into the system and mm-hmm. continue to grow more algae.
Sounds wonderful.
Yeah, it's pretty fantastic. It's an exciting time. It's exciting research, and I'm looking forward to seeing how the next few years play out. I think as a time frame for this kind of research to hit the market, per se, really depends on our level of investment and the level of interest that we as a society and we as researchers put towards growing algae for fuel. I'm excited to see how the next few years play out, but I'm hopeful that more people like yourself will be interested in this as a means to be able to solve some of our problems.
Is there anything else you'd like to mention?
No, we can wrap it up. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you calling and having interest in this. And thanks for having a program devoted to sustainability. It's a fantastic endeavor, and it looks like a great program.
Oh, thank you. We're trying to keep it positive is the main thing.
Absolutely. We all need that.
I've been speaking with Cameron Coates of the University of California in San Diego, and we're talking about algae. Thank you very much for spending some time with us here on Sustainable Futures, Cameron.
Thanks a lot.
There you have it. Everything you didn't know about algae, and maybe some things that you did know. And perhaps you even know more. If you know more, get in touch with me. If you are interested in getting in contact with the hosts of Sustainable Futures, email iamsustainable@gmail.com. It's all kinds of things to talk about. And I hope you enjoyed the entire program here today. And this program is episode number 22. If you would like to download episodes of Sustainable Futures. I put the programs on the magnificent website radioforall.net. That's radio, the number four, and all.net. Just go on there and search Sustainable Futures, and the first, I believe, 19 episodes are currently available, and I'll be keeping that updated from time to time so that you can always catch an episode, even if you missed it, on a Friday from 3 to 4. So thank you for tuning in, and I am wishing you a sustainable future.